Good evening, and welcome to tonight's meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California, the place where you're in the know. Find us on the internet at commonwealthclub.org. I'm Tom Barbash, author and contributing book critic for the New York Times and the Chronicle, and your moderator for the program. Tonight's program is part of the Commonwealth Club's Good Lit series, underwritten by the Bernard Osher Foundation. And now it is my pleasure to introduce today's distinguished speaker, Bret Easton Ellis.
Thank you.
Bret Easton Ellis is the author of seven books, including such monumental bestsellers as Less Than Zero, The Rules of Attraction, American Psycho, Glamorama, The Informers, Lunar Park, and now his new book, Imperial Bedrooms. His work has gained fans and touched off debate around the world. He's pushed boundaries, ruffled feathers, and grown and evolved into one of the most important writers working today. Much of what we get from our writers is access to the worlds they travel in. Ellis's views of the well-connected in Hollywood or New York or in an expensive Northeastern college is not a tourist's view. It's a participant's perspective, and we get not only the parties and hookups, but the cab rides and car trips, the late-night appearances unannounced at someone's apartment, the desperation, the collision of passion and indifference. His characters are undone by the weight of their experience, and often at very young ages. The tragedy of his characters, also part of their charm, is a lack of self-awareness, packaged in great cars, beautiful clothes, and killer apartments. Their awareness is pointed outward, and the perspective is unerring. Ellis's cultural details are rich, fiercely time-specific, occasionally devastating, but just as often really, really funny. What is revealed has more to do with who we all are and what we long for. For all their momentary cravings, his characters mostly long for simple things, love and loyalty, something to believe in. In his ability to elicit strong opinions, his genius for satire, and his place within the cultural zeitgeist, one could say Bret Easton Ellis is the literary world's answer to Andy Warhol. We are thrilled to have him here as our guest at the Commonwealth Club in the week of the publication of his latest novel. It's actually, I think it went on sale today, so we're very lucky to have him here. So Bret...
How can I possibly live up to that introduction? That was crazy. What are you... All right, we'll try. I'll try to, but that was very, very nice. That was very, very, very sweet.
Well, my first question is, now that we're back reading, Imperial Bedrooms returns to the characters that we all met in Less Than Zero. So now we're seeing Clay and Julian and Blair and Rip 25 years later. And I wonder whether the voices of these characters were speaking to you in advance of it, or how you decided to return to it. Did you have to go back and read Less Zero to access it, or you know, is this something you'd been sort of following them all along the way and had an idea that you wanted to do this? When did it occur to you that you wanted to return to that world and these characters?
Well, you know, it's certainly not a decision. You know, it's not something that comes to you logically. It's not a pragmatic choice to wake up one morning and say, I'm going to write the sequel to Less Than Zero, regardless of whether I want to or not. I was actually rereading Less Than Zero when I was working on Lunar Park, and I hadn't read Less Than Zero since it was published. And what I took away from it was I wanted to badly know where Clay was. And I kind of pushed the question aside, but it kept coming back to me, and it kept haunting me. And what happens then is that you're walking around, and this question is whispering in the back of your head, where is Clay? What do you think he's doing now? And so you start answering it. You say, well, I guess I think he's a screenwriter. And, well, so do you think he's living in Los Angeles? And, you know, well, yeah, I guess he is. And if he's a screenwriter, then he's involved in Hollywood. And then what is really the central Hollywood narrative? It's exploitation. Maybe he's involved with a younger actress. And then it just flows from there. You know, it takes about a year for me to think a novel through without really even writing anything. And then I start making notes, and then that forms itself into a novel. And that's basically what happened. I didn't set out to write a sequel to Less Than Zero, and it wasn't something that I was particularly interested in doing. I wasn't really interested in what maybe Blair or Trent or the group was doing. I was more or less interested in what was going on with Clay. And that's basically how the book came about.
Well, the prose style is definitely a return to the style of Less Than Zero. And I was, but I'm wondering, first of all, if you reread Less Than Zero as you were writing it, and also if there was any sense as you were writing Imperial Bedrooms of returning to yourself, to the young writer who wrote that novel, where there was any sort of sense of now you're almost looking over his shoulder as you return to that book. And also, I wonder if it had been a while since you'd reread the book, you know, and what it was like to look back into it, you know, and read it again.
Well, I hadn't read the book for many, many years. I hadn't read the book since it was published, and then I read it when I was working on Lunar Park. And I read it often, or reread it often while I was working on Imperial Bedrooms. And one of the reasons that sold me on going forward with Imperial Bedrooms was how fun it is to write in that style and to go back to that kind of minimalism that I really hadn't practiced since Less Than Zero. And there's something really fun to find out. I mean, I guess in a way it's like Twitter. I mean, how can you say it in like 140 characters in a way? How can you like get this idea across? And in a way, that's how minimalism works too. How can you convey a particular feeling or a particular thought in as few words as possible? And it can be a fun literary game in a way to play as a writer. And that's something that sold me on actually writing Imperial Bedrooms and going back to that voice. But I didn't really ever see this novel as something that was haunting me and that I had to write a sequel to it. And I didn't see my younger self tapping me on the shoulder a lot when I was working on it, because my younger self was a grouchy old man. I mean, I look back, I mean, what really came forward when I was rereading Less Than Zero over and over again is that a really grouchy old man wrote that book. And it wasn't like an anthem to my peers. It wasn't a song or a hymn to youth. It was actually one of the few novels that I know of about adolescence that really doesn't blame anybody. And the adolescents are kind of as bad as, you know, their parents or whoever the villains are usually in a book that's from an adolescent point of view. You know, certainly Catcher in the Rye can be, you know, criticized of that. But its power is different, you know. So I don't know. It was, all in all, it was a very interesting process.
I reread Less Than Zero, and I was really impressed with how well it held up. I was also surprised by some. It's clearly an extremely dark book, but there are these moments. These are very moments of humanity. There's one moment I think where Clay is at a bar, and there's an overweight girl who's sitting at the bar in cowboy boots, and the bartender is ignoring her, and he has a sort of sense of her sitting in the apartment waiting for a phone call. Mm-hmm. And then it's at that moment that he realizes, he says he had sort of balefully that he has two more weeks left in L.A. Mm-hmm. But it's that sort of that slight moment of empathy within that. And there's also the kind of reflective moments that he remembers the house the family had and you know, the one mm-hmm. that they didn't sell that's deteriorated, and it brings back some memories. I had forgotten those sections, I guess, mm-hmm. the sort of sections, small sections of longing and connection in the book.
Well, and then the failure of to connect, because the past is the same as the present, is the same as the future. And, you know, those italicized passages in Less Than Zero, you know, though they're tinged with a kind of melancholy, at the same time, he realizes by the end of the book that the past was the same as the present, and that there really wasn't any kind of golden era with whatever, his family or his childhood, that it was pretty much, it was the same as it was now.
Can you talk a little bit about what happened after you published Less Than Zero and what it was like to have that level of celebrity dropped on you? What it was like for you as a young man, but also as a writer?
It was so awesome. It was so I loved it so much. It was so great. Okay, you can continue the question. It was like the best. No,
that's what we all feared.
I know that's why you all fear it, and it's not true. But anyway, go on.
Well, I wonder, there's this notion, I think, James L. McPherson said of Ralph Ellison that he thought the celebrity that followed him after Invisible Man kept him from writing for a long time, that he made himself too public. And then I thought that you've sort of turned the adage upside down, because in a way, if celebrity is supposed to keep you from material, in some ways, you found your material through celebrity, it seems like, for some of the other books you wrote.
I guess so. I mean, I never really thought about it that much. I don't know. I thought, I guess in a way, if you grew up, which I think I did to a degree, in a celebrity culture, I don't know. You kind of get the hang of it in a way, and it doesn't really, literary celebrity, I mean, really, what does that mean? That seems so like empire, part of the empire to me. It just doesn't seem like something that's real or, you know, that, or tangible. And I remember when Lesson Zero was published, I was actually still in school. I was at Bennington College in Vermont, which was in the middle of nowhere. And I really didn't feel it at all for about a year and a half because I was so far away from any kind of media center. And, you know, there weren't, like, journalists, you know, knocking on my door. It was very muted, it seemed to me, even though it might have been louder to my publishers or to my agent at the time. But I kind of took it in stride for a while. And then, of course, you kind of, I collapsed a little bit under the weight of it. And it's true, looking back, the idea of becoming like famous or becoming a celebrity seems like a really, really great idea for about a year. And then you realize that you spend the rest of your life just trying not to be humiliated by it. And that kind of is how it works. It seemed really fun at first and really exciting. And then this thing happens where you realize that this persona that the audience and has created because of what they've read about you or what they've read in your work and really doesn't correspond that much to who you are in reality, well, that takes over. The persona takes over, and the more interesting, sexier, darker version of yourself becomes the central narrative for audiences and for the press. And that's a very interesting thing to watch on the sidelines and to see yourself referenced that way all the time. And you go, that's not me. That's not me. I didn't say that. They took that out of context. It's all there to fit this narrative they have of you that, you know, people are interested in. People are interested in that narrative. And that was a difficult thing to kind of dismantle and not get too anxious about. But after a while, you know, you just let it go and it's nothing that you can worry about.
What were some of the bigger misconceptions, do you think?
Well, that I was like my characters, that I was emotionally dazed, that I couldn't connect with people, that, and to a degree, perhaps that was true a little bit, but that I was one of these kids that I was writing about. And I know you had mentioned earlier that part of what you find powerful about my work is that I was also a participant in it. Yeah, to a degree I was, but if I was fully a participant in it, there was no way that I could have written the books. So you can't fully be immersed in that world and not and be able to like get up and have the passion to want to write a novel. So yeah, maybe one foot in the gutter, but the other foot was always sort of firmly in place in my office when I was with a bunch of papers and trying to create this novel that I really wanted to write. So I think that was, you know, but a misconception about me. But there were a lot of things that they said about me that were correct. So I can't like say everything they said about me was completely untrue.
Then at what stage of Rules of Attraction were you during sort of the reception of Lesson Zero? Did you get started right away on that book, or was that something you'd begun earlier?
I was already midway into the Rules of Attraction before Lesson Zero even got a publisher. Mm-hmm. So Rules of Attraction was something that I was already fooling around with by the time, and almost, I think I completed it about 8 or 9 months after Lesson Zero was published. So, so I never had that problem where, the celebrity interfered with the books that I wanted to write.
Right.
Other things might have interfered with the books that I wanted to write, and a lot of things did. For example, with a book that took a long time, Glamorama, a lot of things happened that pushed that book into an 8-year writing period when I was planning on doing it in 4. But that's just, you know, life things. In terms of like what being distracted by your celebrity seems really like wussy to me. I can't really relate to that on a certain level because it's not fun enough. I mean, if it was more fun, I can imagine it being distracting and you wanting to immerse yourself in it. But it just at the end of the day, it doesn't really add up to much.
I was more thinking that as I was rereading Glamorama, it's so fun, but there's just so much going on. There's so many celebrities moving in and out. There's so much of that world. I wonder if that's something, how much research went into that, or whether that was just sort of being inundated, being in New York in the 90s. You know, what about that, What was the germ of that novel in the first place? What made you want to write it? And how did it appear to you, you know, sort of originally versus how it ultimately came out?
My father. It was about my father. So they're all about my father. Every book I've written is about my father, and Glamorama is no exception. Well, I'm not joking, really. I mean, in a way, at the core of Glamorama is a conspiracy that involves a father and a son. So look, every novel, I think, stems from your own loneliness and your own alienation and your own pain and your own questioning about certain things that are going on that you don't understand. And you want to understand why you feel a certain way, and the novel that you're working on really is the answer. I know that sounds fancy or whatever, but it's basically, that's what it's about. I mean, when I was thinking about Victor Ward, who's the narrator of Glamorama, I was thinking about a lot of things that were bothering me about men of my generation, but I was also thinking about what had been happening to me, and we were talking about this, I mean, earlier, about the idea that you become, your double takes over, this public person that might represent you slightly, but doesn't fully represent you, takes over and kind of kills you off in a way. And that's what happens in Glamorama to Victor Ward. So, you know, a lot of things were going on at the time. And then, I've always been pop culturally obsessed. And Glamorama was a great, fun way to, you know, deal with my pop cultural obsessions. But at the same time, I'm not as celebrity addicted as Victor Ward was, but that was his currency, you know? He had to use celebrities in order to make a name for himself. And I thought that was very much of the moment and very interesting.
We talked about this earlier, but his tendency to spout song lyrics, you know,
charming. I thought that was very cute, and I liked whenever he did it, and I wished he had done it more, but I don't know. As terrible as he can be at times, I have a soft spot in my heart for Victor Ward, and he never fails to amuse me and or make me sad. I don't know.
Yeah, I did as well. A lot of your, you know, I was thinking about the things that your characters do to get themselves in trouble, and they're often sleeping with someone they shouldn't, with a friend of their lover or a lover of a friend. You know, there's something, that's the thing that undoes them more. It's not like depravity or anything sort of, it's that breaking of loyalty in one way or another that gets them in trouble.
Is that something that get us all in trouble? I mean, I don't think that's specific to my book. That's like, it's life. I mean, I don't want to get into specifics here, but I've been there. You know?
So this is a question from the audience. What do you see in common between the mood or malaise of the 80s setting of Less Than Zero and the Zero's setting of Imperial Bedroom?
Can you repeat that question?
What do you see as in common between the mood or malaise of the 80s setting of Less Than Zero and our age now?
None. I don't see any. And the answer to this question is fairly simple, because when I was writing Less Than Zero, I wasn't thinking of an 80s setting. It was not something that I was concerned about. I did not think I was writing an 80s novel. I thought I was writing a book about myself. And again, my loneliness and alienation and whatever pain that I was feeling at that moment in my life. It came forth in this novel, this project, the Less Than Zero project that I began when I was 16. And I was not thinking at all about, you know, again, writing a sweeping indictment of the 80s. So already the question really doesn't have a lot of resonance for me, because I don't really feel that that is what I do when I write books. And I know the books have been read that way, and that's fine they've been read that way. I know that American Psycho, for example, was taken as a, you know, a sweeping indictment of greed on Wall Street, which to a degree it ultimately ended up being. But again, that novel was a novel that was that started out because of my pain and alienation and loneliness. That's where that novel came from. So I don't know. The oddies or the 2010s and the 80s, there's just a backdrop to novels that are much more personal. And I am not a sociologist, and I really don't know how to answer that question. I think it's an interesting question, but I don't find it applicable really to me, and I don't know how to answer it, honestly. I could fake an answer, and it would just
It might seem authentic, but it might. There's a risk of it sounding really fake.
I felt so like it was, yeah, it was less emblematic of the particular time and more of the sort of specific skills that someone like Clay learns, you know, when he, early on to negotiate the world, and he carries those with him, I guess, in into later years. The things, you know, in terms of age, one thing, though, is I was following from Lesson Zero and cracking up at all the references to Betamaxes. They're always popping a movie into the Betamax. They're driving around and listening to tapes. And then Glamorama, everyone's always checking their beeper. And then on to Imperial Bedrooms is the first great noir book that has text messaging all the way through it. So, you know, in terms of, you can follow the technology through your books.
I am certainly not a writer who's afraid to date himself. I will say that. It's just not a concern of mine. So,
yeah, I was.
But that's interesting. Yes, yeah. That's true.
But you know, I was thinking about that with so another adage is that you're not supposed to culturally date your work so that it can be read at any era. But I feel what you get in terms of that kind of recognition that the reader gets, that the sort of thrill or the pleasure I've gotten from your books, I don't think a writer who doesn't risk that gets that. There's and in fact, I think it's kind of artificial to imagine that you can write a novel now with no cultural references because we're so surrounded by pop culture. But I'm wondering if you were aware of the risk as you wrote it, if you at all or if you had that adage, if anyone teaching you writing suggested that you have less, you know.
Okay, certainly writing teachers did suggest when they saw my early short stories, you know, what are you doing? This, you know, everyone was straining for this kind of timelessness that to me felt very dead and very empty and didn't feel authentic. And when they were, especially when they were writing about young people or what was going on in the moment, when they were writing these contemporary short stories. And I don't know, it just didn't seem, again, it didn't seem authentic to me. And I really didn't worry about it one way or the other, because I don't think that's really what writing is about. I mean, writing fiction is about expressing yourself and expressing what you're feeling. It's not about, you know, writing a book that will be, you know, insured its, you know, reputation in like a time capsule or something like that. It's not really what it is. And if you're writing for those reasons, then you're probably writing something very dead, and I don't know. But that's just me.
I was wondering, since you brought it up earlier, all the different things that happened to you in the writing and publication of American Psycho, you know, specifically writing and then getting dropped by Simon and Schuster, and what that particular time period, whether it was a really sort of dark period where you sort of wondered about your future as a writer, or how you sort of, what you went through during all that.
Well,
broad question, I know.
Yeah, but I can make it an easy answer. You know what? It would have been a darker period if I didn't believe in the book, and if I believed what everyone was saying about the book and how misread it was and how misunderstood it was. If I agreed with them and I believed it, it would have probably been a shatteringly dark 4 or 5 months. But I really had a belief in the book. I thought, well, that's really not what the book is about, and I didn't set out to do all of these terrible things that critics are attacking me for. And I worked on this book very carefully for 3 years, and I think it's about all these other things. So it was easier than you might think to just, you know, wait out the storm in a way. Of course, you know, getting death threats is not pleasant, and it was the first time that I'd encountered that, and it's, you know, it's anxiety-inducing, to say the least. But overall, I believed in the book, and I believed that it would survive its initial reputation, and so I was okay with that. But it was distracting, I'll give you that. I mean, it was something I could not not pay attention to, and it ultimately took, I don't know, at least 4 or 5 months away from working on the novel that I was working on at the time.
There was a quote from an interview that said that when you looked back at some of the violent sequences, that you were upset and shocked looking back. That can you talk about that? Did you have...
I was. When I reread the book, I hadn't read it since its publication. I don't read any of my books after they're published because it's too painful, and there's nothing I can change anymore. And not only is there nothing I can change, I've read the book thousands of times by that period, and I open it up, and it's just, I go cross-eyed looking at it. It doesn't make any sense to me. So I looked at American Psycho again when I was writing Glamorama, just like I had with Lessons. When I was writing Lunar Park, I'm sorry, just as I had with Lesson Zero. I was reading all of my books, and I hadn't read it since it came out. And yeah, the violence shocked and upset me. It was. It was pretty shocking stuff. It was, whoa, what is going on? I don't remember writing this. And it was, I had to steel myself a couple times. It was like, whoa, that is really hardcore. And then I started to remembered when I was writing it and where I got some of the information to add details to those scenes and said, yeah, you know, I mean, I guess, but that's another example. I mean, would I have pared it down now? Probably not. Would I have changed anything? I don't know. But I was upset by those scenes. They're pretty effective. They're really they're pretty out there. I don't know what was going on. What was happening to me at the time?
Yeah, I was wondering.
Very violent. Very violent.
There's a question here. Your opinion, and we can think of American Psycho, which what your opinion was of the films that have been made from your books. Which do you think best captures the mood or characters from your books? And American Psycho was one I'd say I liked the book, and I liked the movie. I mean, I thought both. I didn't think the movie was as good as the book, but I thought it was successful myself. But I'm wondering what you thought of the movies that have been made from your books.
I think The Rules of Attraction is the best movie mm-hmm. that's been made for my books. And I think it's the one that found a cinematic equivalent to the writing style of the book, which is a very, very tricky thing to do. Rules of Attraction was not conceived as a movie. Neither was American Psycho. Neither was any book I've written. I mean, if I do write scripts, and if I have an idea for a script, then I'll write the script. But I've never written a book that I think is a good idea for a movie. I think they all have traps and hurdles to get over that just are not worth it in terms of translating it from one medium into another. So the one that I like the best, that I think is cinematically the most successful, is The Rules of Attraction by far, by about 100 miles. I know some people don't like the movie. They're not wrong. But I love it, and I think it's a terrific film regardless. American Psycho is a very tough case. You have to make decisions if you're adapting that book into a movie. You've got to answer questions that the book leaves unanswered. It's just the nature of film itself does it, regardless. And so what happens is that you make some decisions, and you answer some questions, and you have a much less interesting mm-hmm. thing on your hands. I mean, I'm constantly asked by people, what's up with Patrick Bateman? Did he do it? Did he not do it? And I keep thinking, is it more interesting if I answer that? Is the book any more interesting if I say, no, he didn't do it, or yes, he did do it? I think it's interesting that there is an ambiguity to the novel. And there's something uninteresting about American Psycho, the film. On another level, though, it is faithful to a degree, and it's very well made, and Christian Bale was quite good, and the movie looks good, and it was made very inexpensively, and, you know, on and on and on. But I think watching that movie, it becomes very clear, at least to me, that that book did not need to become a movie. As well done as that movie is, there's still something, at least for me, the writer of that book, that is, I don't know, an exercise. Mm-hmm. And I don't know, for me, if it really fully works as a film.
How involved have you been in any of the films? You know, what?
Oh, I was very involved in the last film that was made mm-hmm. from one of my books. Extremely involved.
In The Informers?
It's a movie called The Informers, yes.
You want to talk about it?
I don't. I don't want to talk about what happened. No. I mean, it's an old story, but it was, yeah.
In terms of your work as... in your work, screenwriting and reading scripts, I felt a little bit of the effect in Imperial Bedrooms in that it moves cinematically from scene to scene. The dialogue's really crisp. There's a feeling of tension and impending doom, right? It's got that kind of noir feel. I think I read somewhere, and it makes perfect sense to me, that you read Raymond Chandler while you were writing this or not. Is that?
Yeah, I was reading him a lot. But I'd read a lot of Raymond Chandler already, but mm-hmm. then while I was reading, while I was writing Imperial Bedroom, I was rereading a lot of Raymond Chandler. Yeah, his spirit was hovering over the project. But it's also, I mean, look, it's also a novel that's written by a screenwriter. Mm-hmm. I mean, Clay is a very successful Correct. Screenwriter. And once I realized that, okay, this is who Clay was going to be, and this happens to all the narrators that I've worked with, and it's true, all of my novels have been narrated by men. So once I figured out where Clay was and what Clay did and what his mindset was all about, well, then there a list is drawn up of the things that he will notice in his narration and things that he will not notice in his narration. Well, what is the tone of the narration? And then I do exercises, more or less, figuring out, well, is this how the narration is going to sound? Is this how he's going to present the novel? Because even though I am the writer, I am the novelist, I tend to hand the novels over to the narrators. And the way the novels are shaped, even their length, is a reflection of their sensibility and a reflection of their psyches. That's one reason why Glamorama is so long, because of Victor Ward's sort of youthful arrogance and indifference to everything. And that's why Imperial Bedrooms really is a very short, clipped novel that I always felt was almost a movie Clay was writing, a screenplay Clay was writing with himself as a major narcissist starring in it. And that's how that that's how Imperial Bedrooms came about. So you're right. Yeah, there is the noir quality and there's the screenwriter sensibility.
But the prose style rises out of character rather than a sort of conscious decision. I'm going to try this prose style, that prose style from book to book.
Well, look. It always, if you're having a character narrate the book, I've always been, and I've been taken to task by this. I was taken to task by Norman Mailer about this for American Psycho. I really do believe that, fine, I'm the technician of the book, but I still want the book to sound authentic. I want it to sound like Patrick Bateman. I want it to sound like the college students in Rules of Attraction, no matter how obnoxious or stream of consciousness that is. It means something to me. The same way with Clay again in Imperial Bedrooms. Now, you know, Norman Mailer said, look, the task of the novelist is to not merely replicate what is going on in your narrator's head, but to take it to another level and to, you know, have the reader become enlightened by a bunch of things going on, the psyche of the narrator and the sensibility of the novelist, and the reader being able to track both those things. And it's very difficult for, I think, that to happen. And maybe I'm just not a good enough writer to achieve what Norman Mailer wanted. But I understand what he wanted. I just don't think that way. And I think you're right. There is a kind of Warholian sensibility to my work where I do like to just replicate a feeling. And I don't like to do too many variations on it because I want it to seem as authentic as possible. Norman Mailer argues that doesn't make it more authentic. I would argue that it's a case-by-case thing.
Mm-hmm.
So, I don't know.
I wonder about writing Lunar Park, you know, just in terms of if that sense of one writing about oneself, which you do at times, or writing about things, people from your life, writing about your father. I know that Lunar Park, a lot of those issues in terms that you're thinking about in your father are right through Lunar Park, but also that you have a character who's narrating it, who's Bret Easton Ellis, who has published a book called Less Than Zero, and you talk about that literary celebrity. But you spike it up, I imagine? I mean, is it, it's kind of, people are, I was curious, I was reading it with a little bit of envy of your, of sort of the fun of it and some horror at times in the beginning of it as you sort of described that. Is it a satire on literary memoirs or celebrity memoirs more? What did you start with that book?
My father. It was about my father again. He was tapping me on the shoulder. I don't know. Lunar Park started out really innocently because I wanted to write a Stephen King novel, like many, many, many years ago. Like I'm talking about while I was working on American Psycho, I thought, okay, American Psycho was a very tricky book to write. It took a long time. It was fun, but it was scary and harrowing at times to go. I didn't know how dark the book was going to get. And I wanted to write something light after it. And I remember I wanted to write a Stephen King novel. I love Stephen King. I wanted to go back to my childhood is what I wanted to do. I was sick and disgusted by the world of adults, which is really what American Psycho was about. And it was about my disappointment at becoming an adult and seeing what the adult world was. And I think I wanted to go back and write something that gave me pleasure when I was a child. And it was, when I look back on it, it was like Stephen King books. I liked Stephen King books a lot. So I was going to write my own Stephen King book. And that was the genesis for Lunar Park. But after I finished American Psycho, I realized that the novel I wanted to write, the protagonist was going to be much older, and he was probably going to have children of his own, and he was going to be married, and he was going to have a very difficult, you know, backstory, let's say. And so Glamorama was the other book that was floating around in my mind, and that just seemed I was like the same age as Victor Ward, and it seemed like, okay, I want to do this. And But that's really how Lunar Park started. And then, as with a lot of novels, I mean, when I was in the outline stages of Lunar Park, my personal life just kept coming into play. And I resisted it at first, and then I stopped resisting it, and then it became many things. It was a Stephen King book, and then it was also kind of a send-up of my career, or like the celebrity memoir, and I don't know. It was a lot of things.
What, you know, there's a scene in Glamorama I'm remembering, well, in the beginning of the book, Victor is afraid that there's going to be a photograph, a compromising photograph that's going to be published in a newspaper. Is that how you lived for a while, that idea? Was there a kind of fear of the next thing that would be written about you in a newspaper or magazine?
Well, if there was, it was because a lot of it was unfavorable. It wasn't like other writers who are treated very well or were treated very well. I was not treated very well, and there was a lot of negative press. And so I think, if anything, that stems from the fact that, you know, I wasn't like, I don't know, Michael Chabon or someone who was always getting, like, you know, good reviews, and he's such a great dad, and he's got two kids, and it's like, he's writing Spider-Man, and he's like, everyone loves him, and I love him too, but it's like...
I was going to say all those are true.
Yeah, I know. I mean, he's a great guy, but it's like, I did not get that kind of treatment, and it was like, yes, I always was afraid when I would get an email from my agent saying, oh, no, what did you do? And like, why were you at that party? And, but that was just, you know, that, I mean, I can't pretend that I wanted to be something that I wasn't. I did not really want to be that literary figure, and I was young, and I liked to go to parties, and I think part of the reason why the press did not like me or did not view me favorably is that I didn't tend to take the young writer thing as seriously as they wanted me to. And I guess they wanted me to go to more pen dinners, or they wanted me to go to more like literary stuff, and I was just wanted to go to clubs and stuff and hang out, like anybody who's in their early 20s wants to do. I wanted to have fun, you know? So... did that answer the question, or did I get off on a tangent here?
No, it answered the question, but I'm wondering, you know, before when I said that maybe rather than the sort of parties taking away from your material, ruining your writing, that the combination, as you said before, I'm not saying that's all you did because you worked really hard, but also you had a different route. You didn't have the route of coming out of an MFA program and settling into a teaching job and having a very cloistered existence. You had a different, you led a different sort of life. And I think, I would argue that it seems to me that you got a lot of your material out of living a different life than that, you know.
Right. I think, but that is like, you know, that's the whole thing you just described is, it sounds really scary. The other thing is like the MFA program and the, I don't know. And I have a lot of friends who've been through that. I don't know. Yeah, you're right. But it's, I don't even know if I'm going to go there. I don't know if I'm, but you're right. No, look, it didn't necessarily hurt me, but I don't know.
There's another question from the audience, which is asking about the differences between the publishing and literary world when you were first writing, when you published your first novel, and what it's like today, and also the differences between the your role as a writer and then your life in Hollywood too. But those, so two different questions.
Look, first of all, my life in Hollywood it's been blown out of proportion. There are a couple of film projects that I'm very interested in or that I'm tracking and following, but I am really not a screenwriter for hire, and I'm not writing like big studio movies or anything like that. I've got like projects that I am interested in that are low budget independent movies, and I want to just put that to rest. I don't want people to think that I moved out to LA to like stake my claim as a screenwriter. That is really a moronic thing to do, and I've got other things that I'm doing. But anyway, the first question was about what? The difference between publishing now and publishing in 1985. It's just, I imagine it's very different, don't you think? I think it's very, very different. I think, I really don't know if you can have the kind of intense collective interest in a first novel anymore than you can, or a literary novel. Sure, maybe with, well, no, it's still different. We're too fractured. I don't know if, I'm becoming incredibly tongue-tied over this question. But I just don't think that can be replicated anymore because of where we are now. it's a different culture, and it's not as interested in that as it once was. 1985, yes, there was a collective interest in a novel by a young writer that was vaguely literary. Some might have called it trashy or whatever, but it was still a vaguely literary thing, and it was much discussed, and people talked about it a lot, and it stayed within the sightlines of the press for a couple of years. I don't know if that's possible now. And
what do you think the reasons are, that people are just reading less?
Or? I think people are reading less, and I think people are distracted by technology. I mean, I know I am. I mean, it's just a given. I don't think it's necessarily a cause for despair, but it is a fact. So yeah, that's the difference. And I think it's harder to, I don't know, publishers are not as interested in grooming writers as they once were, where, you know, a writer might publish a first novel that kind of goes nowhere, but they know that they will build an audience for that writer. They'll stay with that author for about two more books to see what happens, to see if their audience gets bigger with each book. But I think now we're in a different playing field where publishers want a big book up front, or they want you to have some kind of franchise book that's set on another planet or something like that, with like vampires and monsters in it. And I think that's what they're interested in. But it's a different literary culture than it once was.
There's a question about your process as a writer, whether you outline, how much you research, how much of the novel you see in advance of writing it.
The whole thing. Before I begin writing anything, I write an outline. And the outline is usually much longer than the novel itself. The outline for Imperial Bedrooms, which I worked on for about a year, has questions in it. Like, would Clay say this, and would he notice these things? I think this is a beautiful passage, but I have to lose it because there's no way that Clay would ever notice it. But let me try to find a way that I can like work these details into Clay's narrative. Okay, it's not working. You know, so it's like the pages are filled with notes. They're filled with much longer versions of the scenes themselves, and that's just how I work. And then that's the emotional part of writing the novel. And then the kind of fun part, but still a much more technical part, is when I'm the technician, when I'm like streamlining it all into prose from these pages and pages and pages of jumbled notes that I have.
I'm wondering about the sort of darkness and violence that sometimes occurs in your work, and whether it strikes me that in a most novel, if there's a place in a novel where you expect reconciliation and epiphany, that it's almost as if you take another turn and you go in a different direction. And I think that ultimately the book adds up to something that has meaning, but you don't shy away from a lack of connection, and sometimes when things look like they could get better, they don't, and they get worse. And I'm wondering whether that is something that you see in advance, or whether it surprised you when you've been writing, when things have taken a really dark turn.
I don't know. I'm a rebel. I'm just a rebel. I can't help it. I'm just a rebel. I'm kidding, everybody. I'm not a rebel.
Well, that's a... That suggests that I am much more, again, pragmatic about things rather than... I mean, I can't answer why I write a novel. I don't know, or how I write a novel. I can tell you some things, but most of the time it's just like... And it sounds very strange. It's like kind of like a dream, you know? It's like so much of this is coming from your unconscious, these connections that other people years from now will make when I read like a paper about work of mine. I'll go... Well, God, I didn't even think of that when I was writing it. But she's right. Yes, that is throughout the novel. The symbol of the fish and the river, and then the fish on the computer. What was I thinking? How did all those things get connected without me noticing it? So I can't. I don't know a lot of the times why I do what I do. I'm just not that kind of writer. Yeah, that was not a good answer, but that was like the real answer. That wasn't a fake answer. I could have given a fake answer to that. I'm in the mood.
I mean, it's like Flannery O'Connor talked about when she's writing Good Country People. She said that maybe a line or two before he steals the wooden leg she discovered it. And she said, oh, my God, he's going to steal the wooden leg. And so I'm wondering if when your character steals the wooden leg, whether that comes as a surprise to you.
Yeah. But, well, perfect example is in Imperial Bedrooms where there, I was creating the outline and I'd been going over it. And then I realized that Clay was going to go to Palm Springs. The sequence near the end of the book that I think is a lot of people are quite upset by, and they feel it's a bit of a betrayal, and it's the beginning of the slap in the face to the people who, I guess, love Less Than Zero. If you feel very nostalgic and sentimental about the book, there's a point in Imperial Bedrooms where that is completely, more or less, wiped away. It's a three-page scene, and I've gotten into a lot of trouble for it. But I do remember when that suddenly appeared before me, and it was an aha moment, and it was like, yes, and I got very excited, and then the whole novel began to make so much more sense to me on about 10 different layers. So yes, that does happen.
Well, I just wanted to say, reminder for the radio audience, you're listening to the Commonwealth Club of California radio program, and our guest today is Bret Easton Ellis, distinguished novelist, who's discussing his latest work, Imperial Bedrooms, the long-awaited sequel to his novel, Less Than Zero. I was wondering if you could talk about the connective tissue that runs through your work, that not just thematically, but how often characters reappear, how Lauren and Victor in Glamorama are appeared in Rules of Attraction. Patrick Bateman is the older brother of Sean Bateman from Rules. Julian appears in The Informers. All that idea of, is that, do you sense when characters are bit characters in something, do you think at the time, I'm really interested in this and I might follow up on this later on? Or how does that work, that idea of...
It happens exactly like that. I ask this a lot. There is no huge game plan at all. It just feels right at times. If there's like, in Lunar Park, for example, I needed a neighbor, and for whatever reason, I thought of a peripheral character in Rules of Attraction to be the neighbor to the Bret Easton Ellis character. And then I could riff on that character a little bit, and then riff on Rules of Attraction for a little bit, and it just felt right. But there's not, it does not specifically mean anything. It just is like, oh, it's fun.
Question from the audience. Would you like to see Glamorama made into a movie, and how would you like to see it done, actors, style, music?
Well, yeah, of course I'd love to see it turn into a movie, but it would cost $500 million to make, and it would be like 20 hours long. And, you know, there's just no, we're in a different movie culture now, and that needs to be a certain kind of movie. Though, interestingly enough, I was having dinner with a successful TV director who's done a lot of episodes of 24 and has made some features, and a very smart British guy who thought of the idea of doing it as like a 12 or 13 episode, like miniseries, like for HBO or something, and to just do Glamorama for a year, and that's it. But, you know, how are you going to get the money to do it? I mean, it doesn't announce itself with a kind of cultural importance that things like, I don't know, John Adams or The Pacific or... Mm-hmm. It just doesn't have that weight that wins Emmys, you know, for HBO. So I don't think that's going to happen in the near future. I really don't know. There is a lo-fi version of that film, I think. And I think you could be very faithful to it and do it, you know, in a kind of lo-fi way. But I don't know if that's happening, and... The person who owns the rights is now in jail.
Is that a problem?
I would think so, yes.
Question from the audience, and one I would like to hear you talk about. Given the discussion, tell us a little bit about your father.
Oh, no. I'm not going to go there, right? I'm having too good a time. You're not going to get that.
All right, a better topic then. What are some of your favorite Stephen King novels, since you said that you're a fan of him?
I just bought one today. I was signing books at a mystery bookstore in, where was it?
San Mateo.
Mm-hmm. And they had an incredibly beautiful hardcover version of the original printing of Salem's Lot that I had never seen before. I mean, it's been a long time since I've seen such a pristine version of that book, so I bought it. I remember rereading it when I was, I think, working on Lunar Park and being not so thrilled with it, or not as thrilled with it as I was when I was like 10, 11, or 12, or whenever I read it. Favorite Stephen King, that was it for a long time. So was that period of Stephen King, like that, The Shining, The Stand, the stories in Night Shift, And then he got into big bestseller mode with like The Dead Zone and then Firestarter and Christine. And I like Christine too. I like the first half of Christine a lot too. But I haven't read any Stephen King lately.
Doesn't he have another name he writes under? It's like he has a million books.
Well, he has a lot. Richard Bachman was one of them. That's right. And I think he might, I don't know what the other one was. But anyway, yeah. But I like Stephen King a lot. Nice guy.
How about other writers you've admired over the years and people who've been influences to you or some of your contemporaries as well that whose work you most like?
Well, I like a lot of older writers. I mean, a lot of my contemporaries, I have, you know, I like some of them, and I like some of the books they write. But, you know, for example, I always talk, I mean, I know Jonathan Franz, and I know Jonathan Lethem, I know Michael Chabon, and I like one of their books a lot. Mm-hmm. And then I have issues with a lot of their other books, mm-hmm. Which doesn't mean anything. I think each of them have written a masterpiece. So, you know, most people don't even get half that. So those three. But I like older writers. I mean, I still like Philip Roth. I still think the books are interesting. I know people think they're going a little bit downhill now. I still think they're interesting and vital. Don DeLillo, a little less so now, but he was definitely a huge influence on me when I was, when I was in college. I mean, and much longer than that. That's not fair. Lately, I really have liked, I've liked Roberto Bolano a lot, who's the New Mexican writer. I kind of keep track. I just read the Juno Diaz book, which I had trouble reading the first time when it came out. I don't know why, because it's so easy to read, and it's really fun. But the first time it came out, I couldn't get through it, and then I just recently breezed through it and really really liked it a lot. And I like Laurie Moore. Mm-hmm. I like Laurie Moore a lot. I just read her book.
And do you like, when you're in New York, do you like the company of other writers in general?
Well, I moved to Los Angeles.
Mm-hmm. Where there are some writers there, too. So.
Yeah, but it's a different kind of life. It is, there's a Joan Didion quote where she talks about how when she first started attending Berkeley, she remembered why in high school she preferred the company of the people who hung out at the gas stations in Sacramento. And it kind of haunted me, that quote. But I get what she's talking about. There is, regardless of how you view Los Angeles, there really is an authenticity to the city that is, that's vital, that is actual. And especially in terms of people who write, because it's a very desperate kind of job, and it forces you to be real, rather than what is a kind of cushy, you know, New York, Manhattan publishing scene, which I'm sure we were just talking about previously about what it was like, you know, in terms of the coziness of the book parties and the gossip, and there's not a lot of money at stake, and everyone is kind of like, you know, in L.A., the difference of being a writer in L.A. and working for films is that it just forces you to be kind of crazy and real in a way that right now, at this point in my life, I find fun and I find interesting.
So you think you're going to stay?
Yeah, I think I'm probably going to stay in Los Angeles. I've kept my place in New York, which I sublet, but I've not been to New York in a long time. I think the first time I'll be there in a couple of years will be on this tour. I've really stayed away.
Do you know what you're going to write next?
I don't know what I'm going to write next.
No idea.
I've had a couple of ideas that haven't really landed. I thought about going back to Sean Bateman a couple times, but the book just isn't announcing itself, you know, which happens. You know, you go through a period where certain ideas. And also, you know, why do you have to write another novel? I mean, you've written seven, whatever. I mean, I'm not going to write a novel just to write a novel. I mean, something sort of has to come to, like, get me to do it. And I don't have a lot of novels that are half written or pages of novels lying around that I could go back to. And the novels that I've had ideas for are the novels that I've written. So I don't know. And really, what would be the big deal in a way? I mean, it's to write a novel just to write a novel is... sounds like its own kind of hell for me. And unless you're not feeling it, or unless you're feeling it, you know, don't bother.
Mm-hmm. Can you tell us about your college experience? I was thinking of how close is Rules of Attraction to your memories of Bennington? Is that where you're at? Is Bennington Camden, mm-hmm. I guess?
More or less.
And did you have a sense as you were living it? Were you writing in college?
Yes, okay. I was.
Short stories at the time?
Short stories, and I was working on Lesson Zero during college, and I was working on the Rules of Attraction while I was in college as well.
Who did you study with?
I studied with a guy named, well, one of my main teachers was Joe McGinnis, who is now the journalist who's moved next door to Sarah Palin. And he seems like, I don't know what's going on with Joe right now, but he was
he's a little freaked out, I think.
He's a little freaked out about things. He's really freaked out about Sarah Palin, yeah. But he's moved next door to her to write his book about her. But he's the guy actually that I dedicated Lesson Zero to. And he was my mentor in college. So, I studied under him. I studied under a writer named Nick Del Banco and Arturo Vivante. And, those were the main three.
And Donna Tartt was a classmate of yours, is that right?
Jonathan Latham was a classmate. Okay. So was okay. Donna Tartt. So was some other writers, Jill Eisenstadt. We were all in the same class together.
And was everybody showing promise at the time? Was it evident to you all that something exciting was going on?
It was evident to me that Donna Tartt had something going on. That was evident to me. I didn't know that Jonathan even had wanted to be a writer until after he left Bennington. But I remember the first time that Donna and I went out, friends had set us up, and we needed something to talk about, so she had slipped into my box. This is our first term at Bennington, the first chapter of The Secret History, and I gave her like the first 15 pages of Lesson Zero so we could have something to talk about during our disastrous first date. Which is,
That's kind of extraordinary, given how
it's kind of gross too. But it's kind of like it's both extraordinary and gross. I don't know. It's like so many things are.
Someone who's clearly from LA asks why you're not watching the Laker game right now.
I'm not interested in the Laker game. Not interested. Who asked that question? I'm just curious. You did?
You talked to me before that this is the first time in a while that you've been on the road with a book. And
6 years.
Yeah. What was that experience like in the past for you? I mean, is there something nice about actually meeting your readers in that way? Or do you meet them all? Do you meet them a lot of times?
It's terrible. It's so terrible. I look out over this audience. It's dread. I don't know what is going on. No. I mean, look, it's... it's one of the few reasons to go out on tour it's certainly not hanging out in airports and being on planes all the time or, you know, being in your hotel room. It's like, it is, it's meeting the people who are reading your work. It's good. What was the question? It was about, is the first night of the tour, actually. I'm about to do like a 6-month tour, and this is like the first night of the Imperial Bedrooms tour, and I have not been like on the road in like 6 years. I've not done anything like this, and so it's all kind of, I feel like a little rusty, like it's all kind of coming back to me.
That's where we're priming you here. So this is...
Yeah, this is like the first night to kind of get my bearings, I guess.
You were writing in college and writing with a good group of people. Were you writing in high school or before that?
Before high school. I was writing in high school. I mean, I had written a book about the first novel. I wrote like children's books, and then I wrote comic books. I drew comic books when I was a young adolescent. And then I thought that I had a very interesting summer my 14th year. And I wrote a novel about that very interesting summer, and it turned out not to be a very interesting summer at all. But that was my first attempt at a novel. And then really, it's like, again, I refer to it as a Lesson Zero project because I don't know how else to refer to it, because there were 3 or 4 different versions of it, and the first one was highly, you know, journalistic, and a lot of it was taken from my diaries, and then it morphed into a kind of a more shapely novel, but still burdened with endless descriptions of parties I went to, and driving around California, and going to the beach, and going to see certain bands, and then the first attempt at making it into a real novel was when I was in college, and that is the closest like representation of what was ultimately published.
And were you were out of college, though, when you finished the book. Is that correct?
No, I was in college when I finished the book. And the book was published while I was still in college.
Wow.
I know, that's crazy.
How did the student body treat you differently when it came out? Did you become a big man on campus?
It's a tiny campus. Yeah. It's really small. When Bennington was packed and every room was taken, that's 600 kids. Mm-hmm. And that was a college. So it really was small. And I was a junior, I think, when it was published, and everyone kind of knew everyone else. So there was no chance to really become a big man on campus there in the way that there would have probably been at a university or a place with like 10, 15, 30,000 kids. So it was a really small campus. There didn't seem to be any kind of shift in attention on me, which was actually a really great thing. I did think, however, that everyone loved me a lot more than they ultimately did, because they didn't. So many people hated me and were very like upset by the success. I didn't know that at the time. I found that out much later. But there were other writers there.
Right.
There were other male writers there. I had peers there, and everyone was kind of shocked that this had happened mm-hmm. to me. And not to them. Mm-hmm. And it was, I was just gliding above it, I guess, but I didn't really sense the tension behind the smiles.
Mm-hmm.
And then there was a drunken dinner like 7 years later where I was asking the guys, who all went on to some varying degree of success, you know, I would ask them, so wasn't that all great, that term, that Lesson Zero came out? Wasn't it awesome? And I got a resounding no. It was not. We hated you. We hated you so much, and the jealousy was unbelievable, and it was a moment. It was a moment.
Because you're so closely associated with Jay McInerney and Tama Janowitz, I was wondering if you could talk about those friendships, you know, and whether they still exist to this day.
Why am I still being compared to Jay McInerney?
Not compared. I'm just saying you've been known as friends of them in the beginning.
You know what? I'm not friends with Tama Janowitz. Mm-hmm. I'm not enemies with her either, but I haven't seen her in 10 years, you know? And it was, you know, really funny that this whole notion of the literary brat pack, which is what it was referred to, which was comprised of Jay McInerney and myself and Tama Janowitz and some hip editors and agents at that time, was that none of us really hung out. Like I had everyone was older than me. Like Jay's like 11 years older than me, and I was 23, and I didn't really hang out with his friends. I had my own friends from college that I was hanging out with. But once in a while, we'd be out at the same party, and there'd be a bunch of pictures taken, and then this whole idea of the brat pack occurred. And not to blow any, you know, burst anyone's bubble about like the myth of the brat pack, but it was a myth. It was a media-made myth. And it's amusing that, you know, in a way that I'm still asked questions about it to a degree. But it's not like in a bad way. It's just I'm always kind of amused by that. I am very good friends with Jay. And I do, and it is kind of a bit of a concern to realize that if we had not been pushed together by the media, by the press, that we probably would not have been friends because we're so different. But I'm seeing him in a week, and I just when I go to New York, and I see him whenever he comes to L.A., and we're really close.
Were you aware of that book when it came out in a big way?
I was. I remember buying Bright Lights, Big City in my college bookstore when it first came out because it looked so unique. I mean, it was really a lot of people in this audience are too young to realize that trade paperbacks were something that were very unusual in 1984.
Very cool.
And the way they looked, the way they were being marketed was very cool. And I mean, I remember walking into the bookstore with a bunch of friends. We all automatically saw that and picked it up. So I very clearly remember. And then I didn't realize until later on that we shared the same agent. And that I now we share the same editor. But he's a good friend.
Good. Well, I think we're just about at the end here, I just want to thank Bret Easton Ellis, novelist, for sharing his time with us. Again, his new work, Imperial Bedrooms, is the sequel to his novel Less Than Zero, and it's out in bookstores all over. And we also thank our audiences here on the radio and the internet. Tonight's program has been part of the Commonwealth Club's Good Lit series, underwritten by the Bernard Osher Foundation. I'm Tom Barbash, and now this meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California, where you're in the know, is adjourned.